My name is Mary Angela Gracia DiTucci. I'm part of the Association of Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders here in Massachusetts. We have also Melissa. I'm sure a lot of you know her from her Facebook groups. And then we have Laura here, and she is a longtime patient. She has diabetes, and she has a neurogastric stimulator for her gastroparesis, and she has a mess of other problems. So how's that for my elevator speech, describing three people and their illnesses? But in order to help. No, I was just going to say, in order to facilitate this, what we ask is that people state their first name when they're talking so that we can match the voice to the person. And if you have trouble jumping in, you can either call out my name, you can call Mary Angela, you can call out Melissa, you can call out Laura. We'll be sure to get you into the phone call. You're welcome to join in. Did you want to jump in and say something?
Well, yes, I was actually, right when I joined in, you guys were talking about, you know, getting your gastric emptying studies done. I've had it since I was diagnosed in 2010, and I've got my third stimulator. I've had to have them replaced. But I'm an RN, and I don't work now, but I'm around a lot of physicians. And one of their biggest questions is, how come we get different readings all the time on the gastric emptying study, and where within there do you call it gastroparesis? So that's some of the education that I'm trying to do just in my little local area. So I'm glad you guys are bringing it up, because it can be different every time you get it done.
Hi, this is Laura. Can I comment real quick just on your gastric emptying studies? I am a very long-time patient, and as Melissa had said, I was actually diagnosed by symptoms and an overall picture, because I spent 2 years basically in the hospital vomiting and nauseous nonstop. I lost over 100 pounds. Mm-hmm. It was horrible. One day, and this is back before Google or any, you know, we couldn't find out anything. Back before
I remember.
My primary doctor went on one of his medical sites, I guess, and happened to see an article about this doctor, GI. He was out in the middle of the country. I'm on the East Coast. That had come up with the gastric neurostimulator, had created it and what it was for and blah, blah. And within a week and a half, I was at that place, insurance covered and everything. I was across the country. But when they did, I had to do 2 days of tests prior. The first stomach emptying test, the guideline, I guess, I don't think it still is if there's 10% or more, you have some delay. Anything under 10% is normal. I get 17% the day before my surgery. You know, I barely make it. I'm like, oh. Then I had to go back and fly across the country 4 more times every month. And my second stomach emptying test, let's just say all 5 of them you would never think came from one person. You know, they were low, they were high, they were all over the place. And one thing that, you know, a lot of people seems to me that they kind of get a little confused, because gastroparesis is paralysis of the stomach. However, if your stomach is fully paralyzed, you're living on TPN through your vein. You are not eating anything. So it does work somewhat sometimes. You know, just everybody's different on how it works. And again, the snapshot in time, that's all that is. And, it's a big deal test. And go ahead.
It took 3 years of TPN for me before I was able to get off of it.
Yeah, see?
So I personally believe that if we could, this is Kristen again, if we could use stem cells, I mean, there are neurologists. That was my field of specialty. I did neurotrauma and ICU. And if we could inject stem cells, our nerves or our stomach could regenerate. I think that's what's going to end up being our cure down the pike.
Interesting. Yeah, it'll be very interesting to see where progress is heading towards us. I know there are a lot of treatments that are in the pipeline. A lot of them are medications that are from this. But again, gastroparesis, where we're talking specifically about that at the moment, there can be so many causes of that. So Laura's occurred as a secondary to her diabetes. Melissa, yours was just because
idiopathic.
You stood in line, raised your hand, and said me.
Yes, I volunteered for this. Yes.
I have. Mine started with chronic idiopathic intestinal pseudo-obstruction, which then progressed to include my entire digestive tract, involving also the gastroparesis. So some people get it from virus. You know, there are many causes. Another thing I wanted to bring up as far as gastroparesis is concerned is that I hear a lot of patients, and I know in my circumstances it is true as well, that suddenly they start to have reflux or they start to have intestinal issues. And as far as the reflux is concerned, it would not be surprising because when the stomach isn't emptying and it's hanging out, because we like to hold on to things, sometimes it just goes up instead of going down. So it's going up to your esophagus. So it's not uncommon for a lot of patients to be having that.
This is Corinne. My doctor told me that because I told him when I lay down to go to sleep, I immediately get nauseous, but I don't have indigestion in the same sense like the burning or any of the other things. And he feels that it could possibly be from that or GERD or something else. And he said it told me that it was very common that you have other things with the motility. That's why they're making me take this test this coming week. And they put the tube down your throat.
This is Mary Angela again.
Are they measuring the pressures with the tube? Is that what you're doing this week?
They're going to do the esophageal. Yeah. They said they were going to test. It says it's a mammometer test for my esophagus to see when I swallow, because I told them it's hard to swallow sometimes. And then they also want to check while they're doing that to see if I'm getting any reflux in any way, shape, or form.
It was the same with me. I had it done years ago. And I'm the same as Melissa, except they didn't discover my chronic pseudo-obstruction until after the gastroparesis. So I think, who knows, the chicken and the egg, which comes first. But I truly believe that all of us, no matter what our cause is, it affects our whole GI tract, period.
Well, I asked him, this is Corinne again, I asked him because I'm still relatively new being diagnosed, and I did say that. I had a ton of questions, and I said, it can't just be one part. It's got to be everything. And I've had issues since for 20-something years. I'm nauseous every day. I wake up nauseous. I go to bed nauseous. And then throughout the day, I'm nauseous. And the new medication isn't necessarily helping that. So, you know, they're trying, but then it's just more medication, which, you know, you put a pill in your stomach and you've got nothing in there. It doesn't help. It just makes you more nauseous because it's trying to get rid of it. So I haven't completely gotten the whole concept of, okay, let's give you more pills so that, you know, it's supposed to fix it, but it's not. So I don't know. It's very frustrating on my end to go through it with, you know, I can't find a true motility specialist that is, you know, I was supposedly going to one, but he left the hospital before I got there. So it's a little frustrating, and they all tell me they can handle it when I question them, but I don't always get as many answers as I want. Or it's clear cut because I keep trying to tell them, I've been trying to educate myself on this, and there's no way you can just give me this basic motility of the intestine and the stomach. There's got to be more to it than that, and they can't give me any more.
That's most unfortunate, because a doctor who does specialize in digestive motility, and especially at a place where the doctor sees more than one or two patients, so maybe a neurogastroenterology clinic, they're equipped to take the whole picture of what the patient is going through, whereas a general GI doctor isn't.
Clueless.
The motility doctors go on. Yeah, motility doctors go on to do fellowship and specialize in digestive motility, and then some go on further to specialize in, for example, gastroparesis. That's their clinical interest. Or somebody else may want to do esophageal. We have a lot that do reflux. That is supposedly the rule of thumb. However, there are some motility doctors who perhaps need to see more patients in order to understand. And that's our role as patients, is to always educate everybody on what it's like, what you're going through, because that's how everybody learns. Absolutely. Does anybody else want to jump into the conversation, either about gastroparesis or experiences?
I do. My name is Stacy, and actually
Hi,
I can relate to what...
Hi.
And I can totally relate to what it's all been said so far, but one test I would highly advocate trying to do is what's called the SMART pill. I just had this test done, and it tracks the motility through the entire gut from when you swallow it to when you pass it out. It gives a lot of information about not what's only in the stomach, but in the small bowel and the large bowel as well. Because if you have problems, say, in your small bowel, it's backing up there. Well, then it's going to back up into the stomach because your small bowel is not moving it along. Or you could have the problem in the large bowel. So this motility test, it's a pill that you swallow, and it actually records data throughout the entire time, and then it's transferred to a software program. And they can analyze where you're having strong contractions. My insurance covered it, but not all insurance companies do. But I see a high fee. It is something that some insurances won't cover, which is too bad because it is a highly, I think, valuable test.
It is,
but
for
I
sure.
See, yeah, and I honestly, I live in Chicago, where you think there would be so many motility specialists. We have none here. I had to travel to Cleveland Clinic to see Dr. Klein, who is a gastroparesis specialist. And all he does is gastroparesis. And he's the first one to suggest this motility test. Now, I did have the gastric emptying done 5 years ago, and it was delayed. But and they gave me all the standard treatments, you know, for nausea and domperidone for motility. But it wasn't until we did the SMART pill that it showed that, okay, look, you also have problems in the bowel, not just in the stomach. And we need to address all of those issues. So it's too bad that this test is not done in more places, and I saw several GIs in Chicago, none of which suggested it, or, you know.
You know, so. As far as the SMART goes, it does give you all of that data. However, like in my case, they know that I have problems with my small intestines. They know that I go through bouts of colitis with the large bowel, but I was trying to pay for it myself because my insurance wouldn't cover it. And they're like, you know, you're relatively stable, you have a pacemaker, why do you need this test? And I'm like, well, we want to know exactly what's going on. My doctor's like, I was very blessed. When I first got sick, I was out in San Francisco, so I went directly to a neurogastroenterologist. It was beautiful. Now I happen to have a great GI doctor that is training multiple residents in just gastroparesis, and he's in Colorado Springs. But all of them go ahead and just treat and assume that there is something wrong with the small bowel, because they know that there has to be something going on. So if you get a good doc, a good motility GI specialist that will explain and do all the other tests your insurance allows, they go ahead and treat for the rest of it too. That's the only way they can get around the insurance problem, which is ridiculous.
So
I wish we could
have a CAT scan done.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
It's okay,
if we could
Corinne,
all have
I've been
a PET scan.
Oh, a CAT scan. I'm sure some patients have had that. It's unfortunate that in our country, in the way things stand, that the insurances dictate a lot of what can and cannot be done, and that includes applying for disability too. You have people in an office who determine if you are disabled enough to apply for disability and get accepted without having to appeal several times and then perhaps finally getting it or not. And it's very frustrating to patients because their lives rely on a lot of these tests, the results, and their financial ability. So it is very, very frustrating. Anybody else want to jump in, say anything?
I do. Corinne, I have a question.
Yes.
It's all
yes,
related
Corinne.
To what we've been talking about. My question is, if I want to get away from just basic GI and I want to go to, say, Cleveland Clinic, do I need to have my doctor refer me, or can I just call them?
I just called them.
Okay.
This is Laura. I'm sure it depends on your
insurance.
This is
Stacy, yes. Yeah, it probably does depend on the insurance, but and for mine, I have a PPO, and I just said, look, I'd like to make an appointment with Dr. Klein.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
and I know, as Laura said, it is pending on the type of insurance you have.
Yeah.
Some will deny it, and some will say, yeah, you don't need a referral at all.
Well,
but you are correct. I'll tell you, as a nurse, you need to call if you wait, even if your doctor gives you a referral. You guys still call the place that they're giving you the referral to, because otherwise you're going to wait 30 days until they get around to those referrals. I would always call, and I mean, if you know you're going to see a specialist, even if you call first and schedule it, they'll get a hold of your doctor and get the insurance and all the, you know, the pre-authorization. But the biggest thing I, as a nurse, want to tell everybody is, I'm glad that came up, is if your doctor is not calling you back or you have a consult, call them. Call them every hour until they get you in.
Good advice. Very good. From somebody who's worked on the line. So great information.
Yeah, just bug them as much as you can until they help you, because they don't know how sick you are.
Yeah. And oftentimes it isn't necessarily the doctor. Sometimes it's the staff that works there that isn't relaying the information, or they just get busy and then they forget to do it, or whatever it may be. I'm sure so many of us have experienced that as well. So she's right. Let them make a call. You have to advocate for yourself. Anybody else want to jump in? No. So for those of you, does everybody here have gastroparesis, or do we have people who have other motility disorders? So I'm wondering if
gastroparesis and the pseudo obstructions, that's,
yes,
I mean,
the pseudo,
they just go down the list, you know, they, GERD, idiopathic gastroparesis, pseudo obstructions, chronic pseudo obstructions, you know, it just, I find it hard to believe that all of us couldn't have all of that stuff going on at one time.
When I was first going through my journey years and years ago, which is a miracle that I'm still able to be on this earth, but when I first started this journey, it took 5 years before I was diagnosed with that chronic idiopathic intestinal pseudo obstruction, the only person in the family who has this. And at the time, I was 68, 69 pounds. I really did not think that I was going to make it. And the doctor, there was finally a doctor who believed that there may be a motility problem. So he sent me to this place in Boston, this hospital in Boston, where I saw this motility expert. At the time, these tests were not covered by any insurance, and they were very, the tests were in their infancy. So you can imagine the impact that this was taking when newlyweds, well, I'm married 5 years. This all started when I first was ready to get married. What happened at that time is when I was finally diagnosed with chronic intestinal pseudoobstruction, the doctor wanted to remove part of my intestine. And important questions, and I said, if you remove part of my intestines, do you feel that I will be 100% better? Will it cure me? And they said, I don't know. Will you guarantee that it will progress if I have this disease intestine removed? No, we can't guarantee that. Well, we don't think it will make you worse. That was the reply. Every question I asked that was begging for an answer, the answer was not in communion to what I was thinking. The unanswered questions, they didn't have any answers. So I, at that time, opted not to have surgery, one of the best decisions of my life. As a result of that, the doctor stormed out of the room. My husband was right by my side. I was in a johnny on the table, and the doctor said, I refuse to treat you anymore unless you see a psychiatrist. I think you are trying to be a martyr. You have something to gain by not going through the surgery. He was very upset with my husband for standing by my decision, and with that, he slammed the door and walked out of my life. And then I had to just go to a small little clinic down the street to help with what I was going through, and of course, nobody knew anything about it. And I say that was
you
the best.
You became your own doctor.
Yes, and exactly. And not only
that's
that, but
the worst
I.
Thing.
Yeah, but that happens to so many patients where they end up becoming their own doctor and then trying to figure out what's going on. This doctor and all of the experts that I was seeing at the time felt that I was not going to live a year more. That was it, and that I wasn't to do anything. And what was interesting is, so that was way, way back in time. In 1991, I had our first symposium and for this organization. It had a different name. The organization had a different name at the time. And I had all of these doctors, some who actually, the head of the motility GI department at that time was on our board. And he heard my story. He heard me talking about it. And he came to me after the program. And he said to me, I just want to say I'm sorry. I'm sorry because at that time we were doing the best we could. That's all we knew at that time. And I'm sorry that you had to go through that. And, you know, I never expected that. But it certainly put a curve in my thought process and journey that the doctors were just trying to help in the only way they knew. But I knew that I couldn't take that option. Now I've heard that so many patients who've had surgery for pseudoobstruction end up having multiple surgeries. And
And then they get short bowel syndrome. It creates a whole myriad of new problems. And that's something like I hearing you talk, I can't turn my nurse brain off. So I'm all the time collecting data and all this stuff. And you are probably in the group of patients. When I got diagnosed, there wasn't hardly any information there, but there was some. And there were lots of, medical journals and research that I found the research came from women like you in the 80s and 90s that started getting this. Like, you guys were the frontiers of paving the road for those of us coming behind you, I can't imagine going through it in 1981. They didn't know anything about it. I just, my heart just goes out to you. I know how it feels to be told, because I was the same way. They were like, you're going to die. There's nothing more we can do. Four different times. And now I'm like, I'm not dying, you know. But I, for you to still be surviving, that is a miracle. I mean, truly.
I'm blessed. I never thought that I'd be a senior citizen. And I just am, every time it's my birthday, I send a text message in the wee hours of the morning to all my family members. And I say how blessed I am and how I'm celebrating not only my birthday, but every day of my life.
Oh.
And how wonderful it is having them in it. Because when you have these illnesses, I'm sure so many of us can relate, it really makes you appreciate so many things in life that so many people take for granted, including the ability to eat. I mean, how many of you were well able to eat and all of that growing up, and then suddenly all that came to a halt? And I think that really, I say this all the time, I know so many of you have heard it over and over and over, but that's okay, because I think that all of you, with the struggles that you're going through, are just amazing individuals. And though you don't feel strong, I'm sure at times, when you look at all you've been going through, deep down inside, you are, there's that seed of strength in you that says, I'm not going to let this get a hold of me. You can either be the victim or you can be the victor over the circumstances. It's all a matter of what you do and how you process it. But support is very important, too, because patients who don't have people in their lives or are on a part of a support group can feel very much alone. I'm sure Melissa, who has, how many Facebook groups do you have, Melissa?
How many Facebook groups? More than 50.
And you can just, I'm sure in your experience with all the people who really don't have anybody in their life that understands and that they can talk to, with the exception of their groups, correct?
It happens all the time. That is a very common scenario. We have one main group, what I call the main group, that is the largest, and that's where we kind of try to get people to start out. You know, if you're newly diagnosed and you want basic information, this group is probably your best bet. And there are a lot of people who join and say, I had no idea there were other patients out there like me. You know, I thought I was the only one. I don't have any family. I don't have any friends. I have no one to talk to about this. And the group becomes their family. And we have people post all the time saying, you all are closer to me than any family member or friend I've ever had, because you understand. You get it.
Yeah. So important.
That's,
because if you're not talking,
that hurts.
Yeah. Go ahead. First name. You can try to remember to say your
Kristen.
First name every time
you
talk.
I'm sorry. It's Kristen again. That's the part that, you know, I mean, that's the part that's the hardest, is people that don't have support. And I can't, like I said, I can't work anymore. So I try to do things, you know, nursing things outside of the, you know, work. And a lot of it is just education. I can't believe, I mean, I'm not a shy person. When I walk in somewhere, I don't care if it's a restaurant, I'll pull up my shirt, show them my stimulator. You know, if ordering something weird, they're looking at me like I'm crazy. But I certainly feel like the support is huge. And when I found Melissa's support group, that main one, I literally just cried, because I was so happy, because I was like, how can I help any of these patients understand what's going on? How, and it's easy, you know, now in the groups, there's all that support there. I'm similar to your story. I got sick. I was about to get remarried, and I ended up getting divorced. I was working as a nurse at Stanford in the ICU, and I dropped so much weight, and I was not real big anyway. So I lost too much weight and had to quit. Losing our own identities, I didn't realize how much of our identity we place on our job or our families, you know, our spouses. But if those people aren't supportive, I know that when I finally left my ex-husband, I started getting better because I wasn't being broken down every day by someone who didn't understand my disease.
Yes. It's, I always say that when you have a chronic illness, it either strengthens relationships or breaks them.
Mm-hmm.
And through this organization, I have talked to spouses, both the sick as well as the well, and partners. And what I have learned and what they have revealed has been just heart-wrenching, absolutely heart-wrenching. Mm-hmm. I always allude to the case that there was one man who got on the phone because his wife was ill, and he said, I'm sick and tired of coming home and seeing my wife in bed, constantly throwing up, constantly complaining all the time. Who wants to be around that? I think she's breaking it. And so the wife got on the phone, too. She was listening. I tried to explain to him. Everything was good. A week later, he said, I can't take it anymore. I'm leaving her. That's it. I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the end. Never heard from them again. Very sad. That was one of the most brokenhearted cases because you feel so helpless as you know what that patient is going through and you're trying to explain it to somebody who really doesn't want to get it because he's just so frustrated.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough. It's very tough. I've been very fortunate, and this is Mary Angela, by the way. I've been very fortunate. My husband, we have taken all our vows to the extreme, for better, for worse, richer, for poorer, and health. And he has stood by through every test, every tear, and it's, you know, how many people have that? I'm just truly blessed, but I know that there are so many that aren't. And I know Laura, your husband, has been with you. Laura, are you still there? Oh, she might have left. Yeah, her husband has been with her as well, who's sick. And then Melissa, you have a husband and a daughter, brilliant daughter.
Well, thank you.
But everybody in your groups know that.
my husband, this is Melissa,
amazing.
And my husband and daughter make all the difference in the world for me. And I see people in the groups all the time that say, you know, my husband told me, you know, he's tired of the house being messy when I come home or when he comes home. You know, what did I do all day besides lay in bed? You know, I just can't really imagine that. I mean, I hear them. I know what they're saying. I hear their pain. But my husband comes home after working all day, and his attitude is always, what can I do to help? How can I help more? And my daughter is the same way. And it is an absolute blessing, and people don't understand how that kind of support can make such a difference for you. Even physically, of course, but emotionally, mentally, just to know that they're behind you and that they believe you and understand, it makes a world of difference.
And this is Mary Angela again. I think one thing that my husband has said and continues to say is, I don't quite understand what you're going through because I'm not physically going through it, but I see your suffering, and I'm here for you, and I'm trying to understand, and you let me know what I can do for you. What a better way to say it, huh?
Absolutely.
So it's, and my family's the same way. They all arrange everything around my abilities and where I can go and what I can do. And if I can't attend, okay, no big deal. We're not expecting you to attend. You just tend to yourself. So it's absolutely wonderful. But I know, again, we are the blessed ones in that there are so many who are dealing with this alone. And some people, even their families have abandoned them, and that's tough. You know, it really is tough, which is why, as Melissa said, her group, everybody in the group, in our organization, we all become family. We all share common threads. Although our journeys may be a little bit different, we all share motility problems. That brings us together.
You know,
ourselves.
This is Kristen again. That was something, I'm glad you brought that up, because many times in the groups I find myself, you know, people are talking, well, for example, like their gastric emptying study. You know, they're like, mine wasn't that bad, but I feel so sick. And I'm like, you don't need to think that you are not as sick because your gastric emptying study wasn't as bad as someone else's. Or, you know, I try and tell everybody that what they're experiencing is the worst thing they've experienced. You don't measure it against somebody else's gastroparesis. I mean, so many people, and it's probably because they've got people that don't believe them. They think that they're just being a baby about it and not handling the illness well. And I'm like, no, everybody's illness, no matter what level of illness you have, if you've got gastroparesis, you feel like you need to throw up all the time. And that's not pleasant for anybody.
Right. Well said. This is Mary Angela again. Very well said. I always say that somebody's splinter could be another person's cross. Everybody handles things differently. So just because somebody is feeling nauseous, but they're handling it and somebody else can't, that doesn't negate or undervalue what each one is going through. Some people have a stronger tolerance to pain than others. Some people have that support. Some people, the therapies work. Maybe it takes the edge off. Some people, it doesn't. So we're all individual in nature. We're all suffering and suffering greatly and trying to integrate these motility disorders into a quality life. And that's a very difficult thing to do. I find that people who learn to accept, and accept doesn't mean you acquiesce and give into it. It just means that you understand that you have this chronic illness. And as a result of that, you're going to learn to make it a part of your life and work with it, but not have it dominate every aspect of your life. And those who do learn to accept their motility disorder fare much better than those who don't. That's just my experience that I have found. And being accepting doesn't mean that you snap your finger and, oh, you know, I'm going to accept this. It's a process. But not only that, the acceptance is a continuous cycle so that when you're in an exacerbated mode, you may need to go through that acceptance again. Oh, you know, I can't deal with this. I don't know what I'm going to do. Or when you're in the hospital, yeah, you may have to go through it again. Or if you get sick with something else, it's all that continual acceptance. Somebody may say something to you that just hits you the wrong way. And then suddenly all those feelings come back. And so then you go through that process again. So it isn't just, all right, I accept this, now let's move forward. Well, you do move forward, but it's not, I accept this and okay, now I can just totally move on. No, it's a cyclical process. And I'm sure many of you have felt that way, and some of you probably are still struggling to even realize that this has happened to your life, and it's awful. And I'm so sorry that it has happened. But your role, your purpose in life is far more grander now, because your purpose is to educate and help others. And that's more than what a lot of people do their entire life. And you're living it. So
you know,
what better voices to share?
Yes.
How many of, this is Kristen again, how many of you guys on here, whatever faith you may have, I happen to be Christian, but after I was not able to accept it, and I'm wondering how many of you guys went through this until I developed a closer personal relationship with God. I mean, I have a great support system. My parents, my son's 19. He actually has a very mild case of gastroparesis, and he has ulcerative colitis. You wouldn't even think. I mean, he handles it like a champ, like kids do. But for me, it was religion. I had people praying for me that all over the world in churches that I didn't know, and I firmly believe that's the only way that I made it out of hospice.
Mm-hmm. Well, people who know me know that my faith is so important, and that's the basis of why I'm here. I know a lot of people, they do get even closer. I have had people who say, I don't believe anymore because of this happened to me.
Yes.
But I have found in my own personal life that my faith has only become indestructible. It's much stronger than it ever has or ever will be. So it is
isn't
important.
It amazing?
I think all of these.
Oh.
It is. Yeah. All of these things are so important to so many patients and their families, I have to say, because those who are part of the family, it affects them greatly. It really, really does. They have to go through an acceptance process. They have to deal with having their once healthy spouse or child or sister or aunt, whoever it may be, all of a sudden not be healthy anymore. Or
that's where my guilt
tissues
kicks in.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I start feeling
guilty. Oh, you're
guilty.
Hitting all of the hot buttons today.
I'm sorry.
You're really hitting. No,
yeah.
No, this is it's great because guilt is a huge thing. How many of you on this call feel guilt? If you're not saying yes, I'm sure your heads are like bobble dolls at this very moment going, uh-huh, yep. Been there, done that, still doing it. So it is. It's so very real for many of us. The illness is not our fault, and yet we feel guilty when we can't attend something or when we can't fulfill something, our own expectations or the expectations of others or what you used to be able to do. I'm Italian. It's genetic. Guilt is just riddled into our bloodline, as I'm sure other ethnicities, but I'm just talking Italian here, and I know if you don't just feel guilt, you're not pure Italian. But I know, Melissa, I'm sure, have you felt guilt or have you gotten a lot of posts about guilt within your groups?
It's really funny because I'm not one who feels guilty. I do see that a lot. I am not one who has ever felt a lot of guilt. I feel bad. I feel bad that I can't do the things that I used to do, but I place the blame where it goes, and that's on the illness and not on my will. Because if this were a matter of willpower, I would have been cured 4 years ago. I don't lack will. I'm very strong-willed. I cannot help it.
Yeah.
It is not physically possible for me to overcome this. And that was a very hard thing for me to accept, that I could not undo this no matter how hard I tried. But once I accepted that, no guilt, no guilt. And nobody can make me feel guilty because I know that I am doing the best I can. I did not ask for this. You know, it makes me feel bad when I miss things. I feel sad. I feel bad for the people that it affects. I wish it were different. But guilt is not a part of it because it is, how can you feel guilty about something that you do not control? You have to believe in your own mind and heart that it's not your fault. And once you do accept that and realize that, it gets rid of a lot of that guilt. Nobody can make you feel that way if you know in your own heart that there is nothing you have done wrong. But yes, mm-hmm. I see that. Wow. I see that a lot in the groups. They feel horrible guilt, horrible guilt.
Obviously, Melissa, you don't have any Italian in you, right?
I do not have any Italian in me.
See,
I'm a German, gosh darn it.
You know,
go ahead.
Have found that, I mean, there are some very strong women out there. I mean, I can tell those of us that are talking, we have that willpower. We do what we have to do no matter what. But it is much easier once I accepted that. I'm like, okay, I have these limitations. And once I accepted the limitations, then I realized that all these other things in life that I was never doing because I was too busy doing stuff that now I'm limited to. So it opened up doorways to, like, different hobbies. You guys did the same thing. You know, you have to change your whole life around. But
yes.
I'm happier now than I have been in my entire life. But I'm still sick. But that's where the guilt comes in. Like, my sister died in 1997. She was hit by a freight train. She was on foot. She was a college student in Clemson. Well, and that's my only sibling. So when I got sick, that's all I could think about. I'm like, I cannot die. My parents cannot lose their other child. And, I mean, it was horrible. That is the guilt that I carry. Like, if I get real sick or something like that, that's what pops into my head. I've gotten rid of the guilt as far as, like, what Melissa was talking about, you know, friends that were like, oh, but you're not, you know, fun and crazy and hyper all the time anymore. I mean, I'm like, well, then see ya. You know, I got rid of the people that were making me feel inferior. And that helps a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think another area that patients feel it oftentimes is their self-esteem and their self-confidence. And that happens, the confidence happens because of the lack of confidence or the shaken confidence occurs as a result of the symptoms being so unpredictable. So once they find that courage to venture out, suddenly they wish they hadn't because something happened. And then there's also that embarrassment. There's that stigma tethered to a bathroom and people's reactions. It's funny. Everybody goes to the bathroom one way or another, and yet it's something that is not publicly talked about as opposed to other things that probably should be a little more hushed that I really don't want to hear so much about that people publicly talk casually about nowadays. So it can also affect the self-esteem as a result of not being believed again, or when you have surgical scars, or you have to wear a bag, or you are on TPN, no matter what it is, it can really, when you're looking in the mirror and you see a body image, it can really affect how you're seeing yourself and how you then perceive what other people may be thinking. And I always laugh at that because so many people say, I know what you're thinking. Well, you know better than me because I don't even know what I'm thinking at the moment. But it's a very common thing that people say, I know what you're thinking. And for you to assume what that person may be thinking based on your own experiences of perhaps what some people have thought or some of the comments that are made is not a good thing. And it can really make you into a beaten down state. Again,
you know, that's something I was going to ask you guys.
Yes, go ahead. Somebody was talking. Was that Melissa who just asked?
I was at the same time as somebody else, I think.
Oh, okay.
No, it was me. Go ahead, Melissa.
I was just going to say it's just a kind of amusing story about my daughter. You know, I go around just, I don't pay much attention to how I look or anything because I don't leave the house a whole lot anymore. But I was going out to with her someplace the other day, and I just got a good look in the mirror at myself. And, you know, it was just horror, you know. I looked at myself and I thought, oh my goodness, I'm going to scare people if I go out like this. And I said to my daughter, you know, I look just awful. How can we go out like this? And she said, Mom, you don't look that bad. She said, I've read about this kind of thing. Sick people get depressed and they think they look worse than they do. But there's probably some truth to that. You know, you get down on yourself sometimes you look at yourself and it's a shock because you remember what you used to look like. But other people seeing you, you know, I'm not saying nobody's going to mock you ever or give you stares, but a lot of times it's worse for us seeing ourselves than it is for other people because we know what we used to look like and we don't like that.
Yes, wait till you get my age. Then not only do you see the difference of when this journey started, but then you see now the rewards of old age, which to me is a prize. And all the scars, all the wounds, everything, even the distended belly, my Buddha belly here, all of that, all of those things are my battle scars.
They're your beauty, too.
Yes.
I am one of those people. I want all gray hair. I don't care. I think wrinkles are beautiful. I really just don't care. I've always been like the hippie kind of thing, you know. So I don't care that much about that or what people think. The one thing that bothered me, it used to bother me. Now I'm just kind of like, I really just don't care. But everybody would assume I was drunk if I vomited in public. And that to me was the most insulting thing through all of it. For some reason that bothered me the worst. People thinking, I remember I was in front of my son's junior high school and I was picking him up. And I'm sure all of us can puke in a cup and drive by now. We know how to do that. But I didn't. My cup was full. So I had to open the door to my car, and a teacher comes out, and she thought I was drunk in my car driving, coming to pick my son up. It was so humiliating. And I had to convince her that I was sick. So I pulled up my shirt, showed her the scars. I still had a central line at that time because I was getting fluids and electrolytes. But that... I can take any judgment. I mean, I don't care. But for people to think I'm out in public driving drunk, that is just humiliating.
God, that's the first time I've heard that.
Have you guys experienced that? Really? You haven't had that happen ever? Oh, gosh. It's terrible.
No, but I can only imagine how awful that is. It's 11:57, so we only have a couple more minutes left. Does anybody have any question that they'd like to ask or a particular topic that you want us to touch upon before we have to leave? Now, everybody's just taking in this entire conversation, and which I'm pleased. Well, let me just summarize by saying that I always end these programs talking about all of you. And again, you are all my heroes. When these calls end, or when our in-person support groups end, it doesn't end there. I think of each and every one of you, whether you've spoken or whether you haven't. I think of every single one of you during the day, during the evening, in my prayers, and then you become a part of not only my family, but my heart. You are the inspiration behind this organization. You're the motor behind it. And I just so much appreciate all of you and really am thankful that you're alive today, that you've come to us to share a piece of your life or listen to the experiences of others. And I think that you're all amazing. I think that your purpose in life is so noble. I'm sorry that you're suffering, but I'm so glad that you're with us. And please do not be a stranger to this organization. We're here for you. As Melissa said, we totally understand because we're living it. And we talk to and communicate with hundreds, if not thousands, of patients. Well, I know we've talked to and communicated with thousands throughout the years, thousands, countless. And the fact that we're a family, I don't know about your families, but my family, once we're connected, we're not going to leave you. And please do not feel any hesitation to reach out to us. Melissa has all those Facebooks, a wealth of information, so much encouragement, support, and our organization, again, so much education, information. Melissa volunteers for our organization. She's instrumental in this organization. We have a couple of other people who are on this call who also volunteer, and I want to personally thank all of you, too, for the great work that you do. On that note, I hope that you'll join us next month, and may God bless you all. Take care.
Bless Bye-bye. You. Bye-bye.
Bye. Me too. Bye.